your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield.
Yeah, Charlotte, how you doing today up there in Missouri? You okay?
Yeah, we're having a beautiful fall day. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. This evening, we've got one of our finest guests we've ever had. He's the author of The Innocence of Oswald, and it's a book about Lee Harvey Oswald, and my gosh, it's so insightful. Welcome to our program, Gary Fannin.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Charlotte, for having me on.
Well, you know, you've written quite a book. Tell our listening audience a little bit about your background for people that have never heard about you before.
Well, I've been studying the Kennedy assassination now for nearly 37 years. I started in 10th grade in high school, and just 2 years ago decided to write my book, The Innocence of Oswald, and the way that I made my book a little bit different than most out there is I use all government documents from the FBI, the CIA, the Secret Service, Dallas Police Department, Dallas Autopsy Reports, to prove that Lee Harvey Oswald could not do what they claimed that he did on that particular day. So that's how it's a little bit different. I've interviewed over the last, I came to Dallas for the first time in 1987. I've interviewed everybody from doctors to, Jim LaBelle to, eyewitnesses. Just like I said, it's enthralled my life for the past, 37 years now.
Right. You know, you've got really a fine book. And I've heard you speak recently down at the Oswald Conference in New Orleans. Did you really enjoy your speech down there and your time down that you spent down there?
Yeah, Judith had invited me a couple years ago, and just with the conflict with the schedule, I couldn't make it. So I was really glad to be able to go this year. And she has invited me to open up her conference in Dallas coming up here in a couple weeks at Crown Plaza there in Dallas. And I'm also the Master of Ceremonies this year for the Moment of Silence in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd. So just a lot of things going on with the plate right now, but that's all good.
Well, also, isn't there a showing of a movie that you have coming up around the Memorial date there also?
Well, there's going to be I'm working on a documentary we're not positive if it's going to premiere or if we're just going to have a brief showing of it to tease people. It's in production and editing right now, so we're really coming down to the wire. But yeah, that's going to premiere at the Texas Theater on November 21st at 1 p.m.
Okay, and then now this book, though, my gosh, it's so insightful. And how long did it take you to put this book together, Gary?
Well, it's actually 37 years of research, but writing time.
Wasn't a good question. That was a non-brainer, wasn't it, on my part?
Well, the actual writing time, George, Charlotte, took me about 9 months. And again, I got how I decided to do this was I was speaking at a conference there in Dallas in 2014. And everybody was coming up to me afterwards going, "You should write a book. You should write a book." I'm like, "I'm not that smart. I don't have the time." And on the plane ride home, my wife said to me, "Well, why don't you write a book?" And my comment to her was, "Well, we just have one start college. We've got another child in fourth grade. I work full time." I'm like, "When do you think I have time to write a book?" And she said, "Well, the last I checked."
Okay.
She goes, "You didn't like your boss, and we're not financial destitute." She goes, "So quit your job and I basically went in and resigned the next day, and I've been nonstop JFK book and documentaries and speeches ever since. So,
my gosh, Gary, that's quite a story, I'll tell you. But you know, it's quite an important goal here to get this out, is it? Isn't it not?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. It's and again, we would have a better chance of getting the truth out there if members of the American media, not your show, but I'm just talking about the major media with television. You know, fortunately for people like myself, talk radio is the only format out there that will actually listen to what someone has to say, that doesn't dismiss us as a kooky conspiracy theorist, or, you know, that we're just flat out crazy because we believe in this or that or whatever. So talk radio has actually been our biggest ally for the past 50 years.
You know, every once in a while, they'll run some author out and they'll write a book, and it'll be the single bullet theory, or it'll be the single shooter theory. You know, every 2 or 3 years, they seem to get somebody.
Yeah.
You've seen those people? Well, about 2 years ago, down here at the Texas Book Festival, they ran two guys in, you know what I mean, to speak on a C-SPAN connection. And I think it was actually 3 years ago, 2013. And I went down there and looked at it and listened to it, and it was just... It was funny in the sense that, as much as you've studied, and you really have backed up much of your view here and your opinion with facts, you know. But, the fellow that was on the Warren Commission, I think he was an attorney or something, he said they pondered endlessly about how this could have been pulled off with one shooter, you know. And then our inspector jumps up and says, I've got it, you know. And he invented that.
Yeah.
And well, anyway, he said he told us all about that. Then the first person that was going to question this attorney that was talking about the Magic Bullet series, you know what the question was? Could you expand on the magic bullet theory for us? You know what I mean?
Well, did I ever?
You know, like we really believe that. You know what I mean?
Well, Spectre called it his single bullet conclusion. I'm not going to say what most of us call it, but
right.
I actually met and debated Arlen Spectre back in, I believe it was 93. At the ASK conference in Dallas, and it was a assassination symposium on Kennedy. I think how they got ASK out of it. But one of the things that I asked him was to explain the magic bullet theory, the single bullet conclusion, as he calls it, to the audience. And our inspector said, well, Gary, it's been so long ago, I don't know if I can remember. And I said to him, I said, well, would you like me to explain it to him? Because I wasn't born yet, but I know what it is. I said, and besides the marriage of your wife and the birth of your children, it's the most important thing you've ever done in your life. How can you sit there and tell these people you don't know about it? And he actually got up and walked off the stage and walked out on us. So,
yeah. Well, you got the guts, Gary. I'll say that. You know, but you got truth behind you too. That's what it takes. You know.
Exactly. Well, I mean, there's plenty of documented books out there trying to show Arlen Specter trying to recreate the single bullet conclusion in the garage there, and I mean, he can't even line up with the dowel rod that he's using. He can't even line up how the shots are supposed to have happened, yet he claims that, you know, this is the way that it happened, and we should all just believe in it.
Right. There's been a man by the name of James Files. Does he figure into this, to any of your theories, or what is that? What's about him? I know he has a video. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't put a lot of faith in James Files.
Okay.
And the only reason, George, Charlotte, why I say that is this was obviously a very well thought out planned murder.
Okay. Right.
James Files at the time in 1963 would have been 19 years old, and he claims that they came to him last minute to be the shooter.
Right.
I'm sorry, I don't believe that would happen. This had been planned for probably at least a year in advance, if not more than that. My viewpoint of it is it's probably planned ever since the Bay of Pigs invasion, at the least.
Okay.
So again, James Files would have been a 16 to 17 year old kid then. They wouldn't have come to a 19 year old nobody, and I'm not putting the guy down, but I'm just saying, he wasn't Marines, he wasn't Army intelligence, he wasn't Naval intelligence, he wasn't CIA, He wasn't FBI. He wasn't, you know, any of that. They just wouldn't randomly pick this 19-year-old kid to be the assassin of the president.
Okay, okay. Yeah, it took some planning, didn't it? Or you're thinking maybe they started planning it a year before the actual event?
I would say I would say at least a year. If not all the way back to the Bay of Pigs, when the military industrial complex and the CIA that wanted the Vietnam War and to invade Cuba, when Kennedy said, "I'm not providing air support for Cuba," and then, you know, wrote out National Security Memorandum 263 and basically went to withdraw the troops from Vietnam. I mean, he had no plans for war. His peace speech at the American University on June 10th of 63, I mean, he had no plans for war, and that disturbed the CIA and the military industrial complex because that's their moneymaker.
Right. How many different reasons do you think have you come up with over the years of the different factions that wanted him removed? What kind of main other reasons would there be? Not only the Vietnam War that he wanted to pull out, but were there other reasons too? There were other interests that wanted him removed from power?
Vietnam War, he had already made secret back channel agreements with Khrushchev to not invade Cuba. He was threatening the Federal Reserve with changing the monetary system, backing it by silver certificates. He had a lot of things that he was working on that, and bottom line, it all falls down to the issue that he wanted peace in his lifetime, peace for all time. And the powers that be, again, they need the money for the war, for the military budget, and you know, they wanted to control everything, and they just felt like they couldn't get it done with Kennedy in power. I mean, several other things that he was getting ready to do. He had already told J. Edgar Hoover on January 1st, 1965, you turn 70 years old, and that's the federal mandatory retirement age for a government employee. So if I win re-election, you're out of a job.
Really?
Well, the first thing that Johnson did after he became president was appoint Hoover director for life.
Oh my God!
Okay, he had already started leaking stories to Life magazine. They were printed actually on November 8th and November 22nd of 63, involving the Billy Solis's cotton allotment and the Bobby Baker scandals going on. And the final edition of December 6th, Life. They were actually Robert Kennedy was releasing them to Life magazine on November 8th, November 22nd, and December 6th. And on the December 6th issue, it was basically going to be so damning against Johnson, he was going to be forced to resign, and Robert Kennedy was going to bring him up on corruption and bribery charges, and the man was going to jail for the rest of his life. If that's not a motive for murder, I don't know what is.
Boy, that's a big one, isn't it? Huh? I've heard other things, too. One of your chapters is The Forces of Darkness before November 22nd, 1963.
Correct.
Are these some of the ideas that you've uncovered through your deep research about different factions and different motives? I guess the Cuban nationalists, LBJ's motives were right there. But
Most definitely. I mean, you know, yeah. Most people have seen the original Nigel Turner, The Men Who Killed Kennedy from 1988,
right,
with Joseph here on there admitting, you know, 13 days before the assassination that it's going to, you know, that he's a marked man and that it'll happen from a high-powered rifle from an office building. He admits that they'll pick somebody up immediately just to throw the public off, which is what they did. They actually arrested Oswald within 70 minutes at the Texas Theater. And if you remember in my book, I've got Oswald's arrest report, and four Dallas police officers signed this report that said at 1:40 p.m., this man shot and killed President John F. Kennedy and Officer Tippett and seriously wounded Governor Connally without even doing an investigation yet. They knew this man was guilty. How many crimes have we seen where we know the person who is probably guilty, but they're not arrested for weeks, sometimes months? Trials take years. Most people that I know of do not believe O.J. Simpson was innocent, but we didn't even arrest him until almost 2 weeks after his wife and Ron Goldman were killed. Okay, most people, and fortunately, you know, this person was convicted, but most people in the Lacey Peterson with her unborn child, Connor, most people knew that Scott was the primary target. They didn't arrest him for 3 to 4 months after that. Yeah, here's the murderer of the president of the United States, and they know within 70 minutes that this is the guy that did it. I just don't buy it. There were certain elements of the Dallas Police Department. There were certain elements of the media that was on board from the very beginning.
Right. It was well orchestrated, and they carried it off, didn't they? Huh?
Most definitely.
And then everyone that seemed like to me, and through your research, you probably agree that everyone that participated on some level, they all elevated them in the office, you know? That's what it seemed
like. Almost definitely. Everybody had something to gain.
Yeah, they were. Then there's that, you know, and then that party there at Murkison's, were that many of the people that were involved? They all got together and they were going to sort of pre-celebrate this coming event or what? What happened there?
Well, I think it was planned out, and that the party was just basically a faction of everybody getting their story straight. Obviously, it was well planned out ahead of time. But again, everybody at that party had something to lose if JFK stayed alive. Clint Murchison and H.L. Hunt, the two richest men in the world, JFK was about to sign the oil depletion allowance tax, which would have taken away 27.5% of their tax write-offs. That's millions of dollars a day to them. Again, another good motive for murder. Again, J. Edgar Hoover was there. He was already told he was going to be out of the FBI.
Right.
Lyndon Johnson was there. He already knew, you know, with the November 8th and November 22nd Life magazine, that he's going to be dumped from the ticket. And President Kennedy even said on November 19th in the White House, his secretary, Edmund Lincoln, asked him, who's going to be your vice president in 64? And JFK said, it will not be Lyndon. And then at that same Murchison party, as LBJ is leaving, he says to his mistress, Madeline Brown, he says, you know, after tomorrow, those blankety-blank Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's not a threat. That's a promise. And she even called him back the next day at the Texas Hotel, and he repeated the same comment to her. And a lot of people, including, you know, other reporters and so forth, have really discredited Madeline Brown. When I interviewed her in the mid-90s, I found her to be very credible. You know, she wasn't out for, you know, fame, money, anything. I mean, she had Stephen, her son, was Lyndon Johnson's, you know, son, who mysteriously died at 39 years old of cancer. But, I mean, just a lot of things. You know, there were plenty of other eyewitnesses at that party. And like I said, the party itself was, in my opinion, was just a final straw, so to speak, of making sure that this is the way it's going to go down and this is where everybody needs to be.
My gosh, it was so well organized and everything. And those tramps, what about those tramps? I've always wondered about them, that they arrested shortly after or detained for a while there.
I think the tramps obviously had some sort of role. I don't bring them up in my book as shooters. I do not doubt that they may have been spotters for the shooters. They may have been, you know, radio people just to make sure everything was going the way it's supposed to go. They just didn't have the look of tramps. I mean, you know, they had new shoes. I mean, their clothes were hemmed. I mean, you know, they were clean shaven. I mean, they just didn't have the look of tramps. And again, depending on who you believe the three tramps are, I mean, some people, it's Chauncey Holt, it's Abrams, it's Gedney, it's Harrelson, it's Sturgis, it's Hunt, it's, you know, there's so many different people that they claim that it could be. And I tried to, in my book, only to put information in there that I could prove to, you know, a 99.9% certainty. And I could not prove which three people, quote, I thought the tramps were, because I'm still conflicted about it, because, again, you know, you look at them and it certainly looks like this person, that person. But, again, I don't believe that they were the actual trigger men. But I do believe that they possibly knew what was going on. You know, maybe they were, you know, like I said, just back there with radios or being spotters for the parade route. I mean, as we all know, the parade route was running about 15 minutes late. So, you know,
Is there, is there, any, yeah, Yeah, is there any truth in the fact that did the limousine ever stop momentarily just for a second or not?
Well, in my book, I have pictures of the car from the Mary Muchmore film.
Okay.
And it shows at the time of the first shot that the driver is not on the brakes. But
okay.
At the time of the fatal head shot, he is on the brakes, and you can clearly see the brake light visible in the picture.
Okay.
And the thing that I tell people about that as well, George, is, his driver, Greer, had only been his driver for 5 weeks.
Okay.
Okay, a lot of people don't know his original driver was a guy by the name of Tom Shipman. And Tom Shipman was at Camp David alone on October 14th, 1963, when supposedly he suffered a fatal heart attack waiting on President Kennedy to arrive by helicopter at Camp David. They didn't do an autopsy on him. He was 51 years old, in what I've been told, great health, weighed 170 pounds. And I think if Tom Shipman had been the driver of the car that day, his natural reaction and training would have got JFK out of harm's way quicker than what Greer and Kellerman did, just simply because, again, Greer had only been his driver for 5 weeks, and obviously, if he didn't come to a complete stop, he came very close, because, again, you can, the eyewitnesses that were there said the car stopped. If you look at the Zapruder film, would Trevor copy you believe of that? If you look at the next film, it doesn't come to a complete stop, but again, those could have been manipulated. I'm not saying they are, but they could have been. But, again, what got me involved in this case way back in 1980 when I was a 15, 16-year-old kid was there were over 200-some witnesses that all said different things than what the Warren Report said, and I just couldn't believe that these seven honorable men 9 months after the assassination could figure it out, and every eyewitness that just happened to be in Dealey Plaza that day was wrong.
Right, right. So you started it early studying this, didn't you?
Yeah, it was, I think, March of 1980 when I first started. I had to do a report on a president for a history class, and my teacher, he put the most interesting 28, 30, whatever the size of our history class was. He put their names in a hat, and I was the one that drew out JFK, and I decided to concentrate on his assassination more than the actual presidency itself, and that's what got me started into this journey. And like I said, when I went to Dallas for the first time in 1987 and actually stood at the sniper's window, because it wasn't a museum yet, when you could actually stand at the sniper's window and look at it and look at how they claimed it happened, you just knew that if I was the person up here doing that, I wouldn't have waited until he was driving away from me, going through trees and heavy foliage to fire off the shots.
Yeah, Charlotte, you remember we did that broadcast from up there 1 year, remember?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I sure do.
Yeah, go ahead, Charlotte. Tell about that.
Oh, sitting in the museum. It was just a great time. Go ahead, George. I'm listening. I'm learning so much.
Anyway, Charlotte and I went up there, and we got inside the lobby for 4 hours to do a four-hour broadcast.
Very nice.
It was on live radio. And we went, we went to the bookstore, and there wasn't any good books in there. It wasn't any Jim Mars books or your book hadn't come out then, I don't think. But anyway, there weren't any good books like yours or Jim Mars or anybody else in there, you know.
Well, you realize, George, that they have over 100 titles for sale at their gift shop,
right?
And not a single book hints of conspiracy.
I got you. I understand.
Okay.
And people and like yourself and Mars are considered to be experts in this area, see?
Well, I will tell you this, and most people don't know about it, but you can actually reserve a time at the first floor of the sixth-floor museum.
Okay.
And the first floor, they're reading an audiovisual room.
Okay.
Okay. They Krishna, I can't remember her last name right now, she's the person that runs that particular area.
Okay.
Because I went in there looking for, archival film, when I was working on my book. And it amazed me that they have a private library in the first floor of the sixth floor museum. And Jim Mars' books are in there. Robert Grodin's books are in there. Vince Palomara's books are in there. So if people want to actually read conspiracy, they have to know about this particular room and request a time to go in there to read it.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. And
but then they know who goes in there too. See, that's a catch.
Exactly. Exactly. See? And yeah. I've said this all along. You know, the lie always pays better than the truth. Okay. Right. Jim Mars, again, fabulous books. Okay.
Right.
You know, Mark Lane, fabulous books.
Right.
There's been plenty of other people since then that have written great books. Robert Groden, again, Vince Palomara. I mean, there's plenty of people. Not a single one of them gets reviewed by the New York Times. Okay. Roger Stone. Okay. Philip Nelson. Not a single one of them gets reviewed by the New York Times. But who does get reviewed? Okay. Gerald Posner. Vince Bugliosi.
Yes.
Okay. If you write a book supporting that Oswald is a lone person, that did this, the New York Times will review it. You're on the New York Times bestseller list. If you actually write a book that shows anything but the government version, they won't review or look at any of your work.
Right, right. Well,
the lie is always paid better than the truth.
That's what you just said earlier in the program, is people like alternative press and media and radio programs that will have you on, you know.
Exactly.
I've looked at this a long time. I was in the Army Security Agency the day that Kennedy was assassinated, see. And back
then,
Yeah, Charlotte always laughs about that. Yeah, Charlotte. Anyway, we were scorned up there in Fort Devens, Massachusetts, where we went to school, went to intelligence school up there. But anyway, I was 19 then, and I started looking at this from then on, you know, and there were some groups on Prodigy that discussed this night and day, you know. But it seemed like there was someone in there out of Virginia that was knocking down any conspiratorial assertions or theories, see? See what I mean?
Well, when Mark Lane first wrote Rush to Judgment and did his film,
yeah,
that's when the CIA through Operation Mongoose came up with, you know, conspiracy theorists, and it's
oh, that's right. The term itself was invented by them, wasn't it?
Yeah, the actual document number I believe is 1035-960, and
okay.
It basically is in there to condemn, you know, people that say anything besides what the Warren Report says, that they're conspiracy theorists. Well, the very definition of a conspiracy. A conspiracy theorist is someone that looks into events of history and basically disagrees with the viewpoints put together by usually powerful people or government. Well, I'm proud to be called a conspiracy theorist if that's the case.
Well, you know, a friend of mine, Eric Samuelson, re-spoke that term or coined it, conspiracy scholars.
There you go.
Well, you like that, huh? Oh, Eric Sanderson, he and I and a bunch of us used to hold these meetings in Austin, you know. We studied all of these different, you know, aspects of this. So he said that we're conspiracy scholars, not theorists or, you know, nutcases.
Right.
But they try to dismiss a lot of this stuff, you know what I mean. But your work on this was phenomenal, what you did on this.
Well, thank you, George. With you being in Austin there, you know, you're right there at the belly of the beach with Ed Clark's law firm and so forth as well.
Right. Now, Barr McClellan, right? He was spoke down there in New Orleans recently, I noticed.
Correct.
And he has quite a lot to say too, doesn't he?
Yeah, Barr actually, that's one amazing thing about when you write a book, like I did, it's amazing the people that you will have that will actually buy your book and contact you. And one of the first people that connected with me was Barr McClellan.
Right.
And after reading my book, I mean, him and I talk now all the time, but after reading my book, Barr is wanting to put forth plans basically to get Lee's name cleared. Now, it can't be a quote pardon because he was never convicted at trial, even though everybody in the government and the news agencies says that he's guilty, even though he was never convicted of anything. So we're looking at alternate routes to get his name cleared. And we've got a plan in place to do that, and hopefully that'll come to fruition probably about the middle of next year.
Right. Well, you know, Oh, that's great. At that New Orleans Oswald conference, we had St. John, what, Hunt was there, and Roger Stone. I interviewed him outside in the foyer there for about 10 minutes. And he's always very, very well-spoken, isn't he, Roger Stone?
Exactly. Yeah, actually, Roger wrote one of the previews of my book, and it's actually on the back cover of my book. So.
Right, right. Now, you get into in your book the killing of J.D. Tippit also. That was a policeman that they say confronted Lee Harvey Oswald. Isn't that the way the story goes? Is that, and then
correct.
Lee Harvey killed him or something? But there's holes in
correct.
That. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the biggest hole in the story is that the chief person that the government, the Warren Commission, relied so heavily upon was a woman by the name of Helen Markham. Helen Markham, at the time in 63, I believe she was 45 years old, and she was walking to the corner of 10th and Patton Street to catch her bus to go to work. And so her bus picked up at 10th and Patton at 1:15, and in my book, Helen Markham signs a police affidavit that at 1:06 p.m., this man, that was talking to the officer through the window of the car, they walked around the front of the car, and this man shot the police officer 3 or 4 times. Well, the other problem that the Warren Commission has is when they interviewed Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper at Gladys Johnson's house at 1026 North Beckley, she said the last that she saw Oswald was at 1:04 standing out on the corner bus stop, okay? It's 9/10 of a mile between the two addresses.
Okay.
He couldn't get there. He couldn't get there in 2 minutes if he didn't have a car.
Right. Okay? Right. Okay.
The other problem that they had was when the police showed up, obviously there were no fingerprints, on the car. But the story that Helen Markham said that he had been talking to Tippit through the window. Well, when they got there, the passenger side window of the police cruiser was rolled up. So she said that he was leaning in and talking to the police officer. Well, obviously the window was rolled up. So the Warren Commission said, well, the little small window, ventilation window was open, and that's how he was talking to him. And the way the Warren Commission changed the time of death of Tippit is, again, it's in my book, they used the authorized permit for autopsy from Methodist Hospital from where Tippit arrived, DOA, at 1:15 p.m. So they just changed the time of his death from 1:06 to 1:15 to allow Oswald 11 minutes to get to 10th and Patton by walking. But again, their key eyewitness said that he did this at 1:06, which only gives him 2 minutes to cover 9/10 of a mile.
Okay. So there's a bunch of holes in that. Yeah.
Well, and not only holes in that, but I mean, again, he had, Officer Tippit had 4 shots in him, 2 from a .38 revolver, 2 from a .38 automatic. Well, Oswald didn't own an automatic. The shell casings are not interchangeable. They're different in length. And then for some reason, if Oswald did do the shooting, he supposedly emptied the 2 shell casings from the revolver there at the crime scene, and Officer J.M. Poe marks them with his initials for chain of evidence. Well, the problem was, is after Oswald was dead and the Warren Commission is doing their, quote, investigation, they show the shell casings to Officer J.M. Poe for his testimony, and his initials are no longer on the shell casing. So, you know, again, there's so much evidence that in a court of law, he would have never been found guilty, and that's one of the first things that Jim LaBelle said to me when I interviewed Jim LaBelle in 1988. Now, Jim, it was the lead investigating officer. He's the guy in the white suit that was handcuffed to Oswald. Jim thinks Oswald is guilty, okay? I'm not trying to misrepresent Jim at all. He thinks he's guilty of something,
okay?
But he told me in 1988, had we gone to trial on what we had on Lee Harvey Oswald at the time of his death, he would have never have been found guilty because at that point, they didn't have any proof that he owned the guns. They didn't have any proof that he fired the weapons. The FBI could not find fingerprints on the rifle, on the revolver. I mean, just so many things that just proved his innocence. And one of the things that also cracks me up about this killing of Tippit is they claim when Officer McDonald approached him in the theater that Oswald pulled his weapon, his revolver, and he was going to basically shoot his way out of there. but that the weapon misfired. Well, when they looked at the weapon, the firing pin, the trigger, was not in alignment with the bullet chamber. So, in other words, if he did fire a shot, it wouldn't connect to send the bullet anyhow.
Oh,
well,
okay.
How did it work 32 minutes earlier when you killed Tippett?
Right. I got you.
I mean, there's just so many indiscrepancies in Officer Tippett's death. And, you know, again, it's a horrible thing, you know, for his family and everything. His family's life was completely changed, and I in no way do not want to take away from Officer Tippett's death. I mean, like I said, it's very possible he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right, exactly. Now, you have other chapters. One of them is the Malcolm Wallace fingerprint.
Uh-huh.
Was that up in the sniper's nest there, on the boxes or something? Where was that found?
Yeah, it was located on a cardboard box in the sixth floor corner window, what they deemed as the sniper's nest. And after all of the employees and all the police officers and everybody that was up there was systematically erased as having left that fingerprint. The fingerprint was lifted, and basically it sat in the National Archives for 35 years until Professor Walt Brown got the fingerprint and basically gave a redacted card for when Malcolm Wallace was arrested in 51 for killing Kinzer, and took it to Nathan Darby there in Austin. And Nathan Darby originally had a 14-point match, and later on came back and said he had a 34-point match. And there's been a lot of people since then that have said that, well, Nathan Darby, you know, he wasn't a fingerprint expert. He wasn't licensed to do it at the time in 1998. You know, regardless, that's like arguing about O.J. Simpson going down the white Bronco Chase, and you're wondering if the registration's valid.
I mean, it's
a moot point.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's a moot point at that point. And at the conference that we're getting ready to have, too, Douglas Caddy is going to come in. He was the attorney for Billy Saul Estes as well as E. Howard Hunt, and him and Richard Bartholomew and a few others. They're going to bring up the fingerprint evidence again. But again, even when Walt Brown, you know, got the 34-point match from Nathan Darby, you know, and took it to the FBI. The FBI, it took them almost 4 to 5 years, but they came back and said it was unreliable, that it wasn't a match. Of course they did.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's such a big cover-up, isn't it, huh?
It is, and you know, and the thing that I think the meat of the issue, you brought up James Files earlier, and
right.
A lot of people know about James Files through the Internet, and very few people know about another guy by the name of Roscoe White. And Roscoe White, to me, he is the key to the entire assassination. Okay? Roscoe died in September 24th, 1971 of a chemical explosion. And in 1982, his son, Ricky, was basically snooping around his grandparents' bedroom. And at the time, I believe that Ricky's mom and him lived with his grandparents. But he's basically snooping around, and he came across a little trap door in the closet, and he found this box full of material that Roscoe, his father, had left. And inside the box were, for example, there was another Oswald backyard photograph image. There was Roscoe's diary, Roscoe's witness elimination program book, a book in which Roscoe, every time somebody key would die in the assassination, he would simply mark a line through their face from a newspaper clipping and paste it into his book. And Roscoe admitted, okay, that he had killed JFK from behind the stockade fence and that he shot a police officer at 10th and Patton. Now, he never said Officer Tippett, but he did say a police officer. And the other thing that is so enthralling to me were the three cables, the decoded cables, which were basically like Western Union telegrams, dated September 63, October 63, and December 63, from Navy intelligence directly to Roscoe White, ordering him to assassinate JFK. And the problem is, when Ricky finally couldn't take this gut feeling any longer. In 1989, he finally took it to the Kennedy Assassination Information Center, which used to be in the West End area there in Dallas. And it was ran by Gary Shaw and Larry Howard, two of the nicest guys you will ever meet in your life, honest as the day is long researchers. Gary was actually approached by Oliver Stone to be the primary technical advisor on the movie JFK, but Gary is a very private person, so he had Larry Howard do it for him. But they took, Ricky took these cables to the Kennedy Assassination Center, as well as a picture of his mom, Geneva, who worked for Jack Ruby for 3 weeks in September of 63, and said, hey, here's the proof that I've got. And when Gary Shaw and Larry Howard asked him about the diary, he basically said, well, I'm bringing this to you now because I went to the FBI last year in 1988, and after they visited me, the diary was missing. So they basically stole his diary. And at this point, again, Gary Shaw and Larry Howard have got to be a little bit skeptical of this 24, 25-year-old guy claiming that his father killed JFK. So they actually took the plastic that the cables were in and a piece of the paper and sent it to both 3M and IBM and said, can you tell me what year this paper and plastic stock is from? And both independent companies came back and said late 62, early 63. So it was clear that Ricky was not making this up. But the problem is, again, Ricky, when they finally went public and had a press conference in April of 1990, I believe it was April, Ricky just didn't interview well. I hate to say it. He didn't carry himself very well. I don't think he knew much about the facts of the case, and he just didn't seem to be, well-versed. And obviously, you've got the media there that is just harassing him that, you know, are used to this. And he just didn't come across well, so his story never, quote, got any traction. But my next book is going to be completely about Roscoe White. I've already started working on it. This is a guy that just happened to join the Marines. He just happened to take the same ship, the USS Bexar, from San Diego to the Philippines, to mainland China, to Japan with Lee Harvey Oswald. They just happened to be assigned as photographic experts, and their main job was to evaluate the photographs taken from the U-2 spy plane that was flying over Russia at the time. Even Gary Powers admitted that Oswald could have given the Russians, the secrets to basically have his plane shot down when he was shot down in, I believe, 59 or 60. But, again, getting back to Roscoe, he just happened to be a photographic expert, okay? So he worked side by side with Lee Harvey Oswald for 6.5 months, okay? When they both get out of the Marines, both of them at that point went to work for intelligence, naval intelligence. There's a lot of credible evidence that Lee was an FBI informant. But flash forward in September of 63, the first cable, the decoded cable from the Naval Intelligence of September 63 tells Roscoe White, Dallas destination chosen, your place hidden within the department, okay? So this is the Naval Intelligence ordering Roscoe White that he now has a job in the Dallas Police Department as a photographic expert, okay?
Right.
Now, October 63, this cable just says it all to me, okay? It says, foreign affairs assignments have been canceled. The next assignment is to eliminate a national a national security threat to worldwide peace. Something in those words. It says the destination will be Houston, Austin, or Dallas. Stay advised, that sort of thing. Well, this one document says we're not going to kill Fidel Castro. We're going to kill JFK. And at that time, they didn't know whether it was going to be in Houston, Austin, or Dallas. I guarantee you, if Roscoe White was in place in Dallas, okay, Naval Intelligence had other people in Houston, other people in Austin that were also doing the same type of job. They were basically a paid assassin if it happened there. Okay, a lot of people don't know about Thomas Arthur Bowie. Again, another Marine just happened to serve with Oswald. He was in Chicago. And when Kennedy was supposed to go to the Army-Navy football game on November 2nd, Thomas Arthur Valley worked in a building that overlooked the motorcade route, and an FBI informant named Lee, we don't have the last name, a lot of people say it's Lee Oswald, I believe it as well, you know, tipped him off that this guy was going to try to assassinate the president. And sure enough, again, here's a Marine. He's got a job just started on the parade route. You know, he's arrested with two different guns, over 2,500 rounds of ammunition. I mean, this, again, this was well thought out years in advance. And right. Again, Rocco White is the entire key to this assassination. I know that pastors, priests, attorneys, medical people, you know, they're not legally supposed to tell you what their clients or you know.
Confidentiality, ethics, and so forth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, in Roscoe's witness elimination program book, he admits to killing 28 people on foreign and domestic soil between 1963 and 1971 to cover up the assassination of JFK. When I went to his pastor, Jack Shaw, and brought up this number, again, he's not going to tell me, you know, oh, that's exactly what he said, you know, but I said, you know, I said, I have it on record that he killed 28 people to cover up the death of JFK and Officer Tippit between 1963 and 1971, and Pastor Shaw said, that number sounds about right. And that was
really
all the information that I needed to know that you know, that Roscoe had made a deathbed confession.
Well, how did, that's fascinating, Gary. How did Jack Ruby figure into this whole scheme on the assassination, you know?
Well, Jack knew about it ahead of time. I have it documented in my book where he went into the assistant district attorney's office the day before the assassination, shook hands with the assistant DA, Ben Ellis, and said to him, you don't know me now, but you probably will. So that was one incident.
My
but,
God.
And then also he went into the Adolphus Hotel, which was right adjacent to his club there
right
in Dallas, and gave his business card to the main bell captain, and basically said the same thing. He said, you know, keep this card, and he signed the back of it. And he says, keep this card; it's going to be worth something one day. Jack was a low-level mafia guy. He owed Carlos Marcello a lot of favors, owed him financially as well. I have that about five or six different people, including Beverly Oliver, was introduced to Oswald by Jack Ruby, and he said, you know, Beverly, this is my friend Lee with the CIA. So, I mean, I have plenty of people that show that they knew each other, okay? And bottom line, when Ruby was finally ordered to kill Oswald, he didn't want to kill him, okay? But he knew his life depended upon him getting killed. And the reason why he didn't want to kill him, he was standing, you know, 18, 24 inches away and shot him in the gut, okay? He didn't aim at his heart. He didn't aim at his head. He shot him in the gut. When he was arrested and taken up to the jail cell, Officer Rose, you know, said that he requested a cigarette, that he was breathing, you know, very heavily, sweating profusely. And then once word came that Oswald had actually died, Jack calmed down. He stopped sweating. Officer Rose offered him a cigarette, and he said he didn't smoke. So his entire life depended upon him killing Oswald, and he didn't want to do it. But, again, the mafia has a saying, three people can keep a secret as long as two of them are dead.
Yeah, right.
So, and a lot of people don't know. A lot of people don't know this. Charlotte and George is, you know, Ruby's trial was overturned. Okay, he was awaiting a second trial when he suddenly contracted cancer and died. So you've got the murder, alleged murder of JFK and Tippit. Oswald never went to trial, and the person that killed Oswald, his trial was overturned and was waiting a second trial. So in the, you know, laws of Texas, both of them are still innocent.
You know, Judith Berry Baker was developing a cancer virus in New Orleans. Is that correct? Working on that?
Exactly.
You think
exactly.
They used that for Jack Ruby? Introduced
Almost
it into
definitely.
Him? Huh?
Most definitely.
Because
Most
they, had
definitely.
To, they had to close down the whole thing, see? And that was a good
yep.
way to do it, wasn't it? Huh?
Most definitely. And again, you know, Judith Baker admits to seeing, she calls him Sparky. That was his nickname because of his temper. But again, she admits to seeing Jack Ruby there. Along with, obviously, you know, David Ferry, Dr. Mary Sherman, whose murder was also very suspicious. You know, Alton Ochsner. You know, it's amazing. You go, when we were just there, you go to New Orleans and the Ochsner name is still everywhere. 55, 60 years after the fact, and most people don't realize that he was involved in a biochemical, basically, weapon to inject cancer into Fidel Castro.
Right,
and bottom line, they ended up turning this around and putting it on, you know, Jack Ruby. I mean, he admitted to his family that he was being injected with cancer cells, you know, in the jail cell. So.
Yeah. What, you know, the booklet that Lee Harvey Oswald was handing out on the streets of New Orleans, I came up with whose book that was, Carlos Lamont.
Really?
Carlos Lamont is the son of Thomas W. Lamont, first vice president of J.P. Morgan that was at Jekyll Island. You see how, I mean, they work us from the left. Carlos Lamont was an avowed Marxist communist, by the way. And then they work us from the right. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
They go, you know, they created this dialectic, you know, system, dialectical opposition type system. But anyway, Carlos Lamont eventually, inherited his father's mansion. He gave a lot to Columbia University. But he had published this booklet, and that was the one that Lee Harvey Oswald was handing out on the streets of New Orleans. And now I've heard, and maybe you'll have some additional comments on this, that Lee Harvey was trying to spot the pro-Cuban people on the streets so the FBI could take photographs of them and sort of get a line on people like that. What did you get out of that? Huh?
Oh, most definitely. Again, I mean, Lee was an FBI informant, and again, when he was arrested for handing out the leaflets, he has to speak with an FBI agent quickly. How did he know who Quigley was? Okay.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I know that Marina, you know, came over from the Soviet Union, but at the time, Marina wasn't even in New Orleans with him. Okay,
right.
So, you know, you can't claim that Quigley was questioning Marina, and that's how Lee knew who Quigley was. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, again, just it all ties in together. Lee was unfortunately, in my opinion, a true patriot, a true hero that was trying to do the right thing and basically got tricked into being the fall guy. And, again, that's the reason why he constantly says every time you see videotape of him being transferred from one room to the other, I'm a patsy. They brought me in because I lived in the Soviet Union. I didn't shoot anybody. He keeps denying everything.
Is there any truth to this two Oswald theory? Have you heard that or looked at it at all?
Oh, I've looked into it some, and I definitely think there were plenty of people impersonating Oswald, after his death.
Now, what I've looked at is right out of the Warren Commission, okay?
Uh-huh.
And they have a passport in there of the person that was Lee Harvey Oswald going to Russia. And that photograph in that passport does not look like the Lee Harvey Oswald that was gunned down in Dallas.
Correct.
What was that about? What the aberration there? What's that about?
Again, I think that they were using lookalikes to basically put Oswald into all of these compromising positions.
Okay.
You know, even look at the Warren report. There's a commission exhibit of a guy simulating shooting the rifle from the sixth floor window, and the FBI shows them anybody, but they pick a guy that looks exactly like Lee Harvey Oswald to do the shooting.
As
if you weren't convinced enough by their 26-volume report, they have to get a picture of a guy that looks just like him. I mean, have you ever looked at what Michael Payne looked like back in the 1960s? He looked exactly like Lee Harvey Oswald.
My gosh.
Okay. The Paynes are directly involved with the CIA. Okay.
Right.
One of the things that I put in my book, and I know we're running out of time, but I just want to get it across real quick, is Lee Oswald was arrested at 1:40. He arrived at the police booking station at 2 o'clock. It probably took them at least 15, 20 minutes to book him. Okay? He never admitted, his address was 1026 North Beckley at the time. He never admitted anything about the Irving address. Yet Ruth Payne, on the Men Who Killed Kennedy series in 1988, said six police officers showed up at her house shortly after 2 o'clock on the 22nd, and she said when they showed up at the door, "Come on in, I've been expecting you." Nobody's announced that Oswald was guilty yet.
Right.
Okay, it's not
right.
been announced on the TV. It's not been announced on the news media. They don't have his name. He's not even arrested yet. How do they know to go to that address and for her to say, "Come on in, I've been expecting you"?
According to her,
she didn't even know he had a gun. So why would she be expecting the police to come out there? I mean, in my opinion, Ruth Payne is the person that delivered the 6.5 Manly Carcano to the Dallas Police Department on the morning of the 22nd.
I got you. We've got about 4 minutes left. Do you have some concluding remarks? And also, Charlotte, if you got a question or something, inject that in here, okay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm sorry it's so quiet today. I'm just fascinated.
Okay.
Well, as far as my conclusions go, George, yeah. I'll just tell everybody, I didn't write this book for money, okay? It's selling way better than I ever thought, but that's not the reason why I wrote it. But my book and the website, theinnocenceofoswald.com, will give your listeners.
We have that up. Yeah, we have that up on our site, thesecrettruth.com.
Okay.
Yeah, we have all that up.
And the other thing I just want to point out is, again, I'm speaking at these conferences in Dallas. If you've never been to any of these conferences, I urge people to go. Chris Gallup has got a luncheon down in Mansfield, Texas on November 17th. And he's got Barr McClellan, Beverly Oliver, Casey Quinlan, several other speakers. Very intimate setting. Judith is doing her conference November 18th to the 20th at the Crown Plaza there in Dallas. Over 30 people directly related with knowledge of the assassination are speaking over 3 days. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a jfkconference.com is the site for the upcoming conference.
Correct.
At the Crown Plaza. And you'll be speaking there, you'll be at the memorial. That's quite an honor to be invited to be the MC out there.
Yeah, it is. And, again, I don't know why I got chosen, but I'm not going to, complain about it. Like you said, it's a tremendous honor. And,
yes, it is. It is. Gary, that's quite an honor.
I'll be giving the opening remarks at her conference, as well as the opening remarks on the EMC at the Moment of Silence. Bob Groden will be speaking there as well. We've got a couple other people lined up. I mean, it's just going to be an incredible 4 or 5 days there in Dallas.
Right. Also, I wanted to direct people to your site. And one of the click-offs there is what, additional research I think you have or something there? How do you... Let me go
through. I've got a listing up there for research links.
Research links, yes, those were good. Yeah,
when you click on to that particular link, you can look at the entire Warren report. You can look at the entire House Select Committee on Assassinations report. You can look at several other people that are involved with assassinations. It just basically it clicks you directly from my link and opens up in a new window. Like if you wanted to. Go to Bob Groden's website, you click on his. If you want to go to Chris Gallup's, click on his. It's basically just another form of research. It's got the Mary Farrell site on there. I probably got 35 to 40 different links on there.
Right, right. That's great. Is Lancer going to be there as part of the memorial too, of the people with Lancer?
They are celebrating theirs on Sunday, I believe, from 12 to 1:30.
Okay.
And again, I may be wrong, but I don't think in the past, Deborah Conway has not done anything with the Moment of Silence if it falls on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that sort of thing. And again, I could be wrong there, but I don't think that they're planning to be there on the 22nd.
Oh, okay. So we've got all these links up, and you might email me that last one in Mansfield. I don't think I have information on that, but or whatever. And do that for me, and I'll put up the theater deal announcement. I'll put up anything else. I've got most everything else up there already on your home site. TheInnocenceOfOswald.com is your site for your book, TheInnocenceOfOswald.com. And so we want to thank you for being with us this evening. And, boy, I tell you what, Gary, I really respect the work and dedication to the truth here.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on, and I look forward to seeing you in Dallas here in a couple weeks.
Yeah, any closing comments, Charlotte?
No, I'm not quite as well-versed as you guys, so I didn't interject anything. And I want to thank you very much, Gary, too, and good luck with next year.
Okay, well, thank you a lot, Gary, and we'll talk to you later, Charlotte. Love you. Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.